Weimar level, but is a hike all the same. What will that do to Britain's politics? A rapid consequence could be a change in the public attitude towards the war in Ukraine. The most obvious cause of the current inflation surge is the rise in oil and gas prices, triggered in part by Russia's special operation in Ukraine. Standing with Kiev and sanctioning Moscow has come at a cost paid by regular people under forecourt and in their heating bills. Up to now, Britons, along with most Europeans and Americans, have been solid in their support for Ukraine. But as inflation bites harder, they could shift. With new pressure on Kiev to end the war in any way, if that's what it takes to get prices back down. Public discontent may find another outlet. The first signs of the kind of disobedience movement that greeted the poll tax in 1990 are emerging, with a Don't Pay campaign urging consumers to refuse to settle their energy bills until the companies lower their prices. Energy retailers will stress that they are not the same as energy extractors such as BP, which recently announced it had tripled its quarterly profits to £7 billion. But few will be in the mood to make that distinction. An inflation rise of this order travels across class lines. Working people struggle because a galloping inflation rate turns even a wage increase into a cut. Meanwhile, the middle classes see any savings shrink before their eyes. If they are homeowners, their mortgage bills will soar, potentially out of reach. And when houses start getting repossessed, fear turns into fury. Where does that anger go? Guardian readers might hope it is directed at the act of self-harm that's made our current woes so much worse. I asked Albrecht Ritschl, Professor of Economic History at the London School of Economics, what single move the British government could make to alleviate the pain. The reply came, suspend Brexit for 20 years. He knows that's not going to happen, but he explains that today's crisis is not one of demand, but one of supply. There's just not enough stuff to meet demand, thanks in part to the post-COVID blockages in the global supply chain. In Britain, that's exacerbated because Britons can no longer import European goods as freely or as cheaply as before. In that context, policymakers are left with a question of distribution, how to share out the finite, indeed shrinking, amount that we have. The priority surely has to be with those who simply cannot afford to live. Restoring the £20 uplift to universal credit would be a start. But Professor Ritschl says, if you want to give something to the poor, then you have to do it like Robin Hood and take from the rich. In other words, not the tax cuts that Liz Truss is promising, but tax increases on the wealthiest. A wealth tax, a benefits rise, and a rethink on Brexit. There would be some comfort in imagining those as the consequences of this crisis. But I wouldn't hold your breath. Instead, memories stir of the last such inflation hike in the 1970s. That decade brought a surge in political violence and a rise in support for the racist far right in the form of the National Front. Under Boris Johnson, the Conservative Party has shifted towards a nationalist populism that Liz Truss seems unlikely to jettison. That creed is already of an ugly hue, but it could darken, especially when winter comes.
Yemeni men, Ominous Shadows.
Part 1.
The war in Yemen was in fact a combination of three battles. Everyone knows about the first war, the resistance by the Ansarullah against the Saudi invasion and the forces supported by Mohammed bin Salman. The second war is a conflict between the Houthis and the Al-Qaeda militants who are supported by Riyadh to make Yemen insecure and crush the Houthis who are Zaydi Shias. But we've heard less often about Yemen's third war. On April 27, 2017, Abu Rabu Mansur Hadi, Mohammed bin Salman's crony, who claims to be Yemen's president, deposed Idrus Qasim Abdul Aziz Al Zubaydi, the governor of Aden, the capital of former South Yemen. The reason for his dismissal was the vast relationship between Zubaydi and a tiny nation on the southern shores of the Persian Gulf. The newly established United Arab Emirates. After the dismissal, a large crowd of Zubaydi supporters took to the streets. The supporters were mobilized by the UAE. Hadi was informed through Saudi agents that the United Arab Emirates was behind all of this. It wasn't the first time that Hadi and bin Salman were informed of the UAE's spontaneous measures. Last winter, Hadi, who usually resided in Saudi Arabia, decided to visit Aden, that was the largest city controlled by the Saudi-backed militants. When Hadi's plane approached the airport in Yemen, as a rule of thumb, it requested to land, but the airport in Yemen didn't allow the plane to land. So the plane had to land kilometers away on the island of Socotra. Hadi was enraged. He fired the director of the airport and ordered the forces under his command to besiege the airport. The UAE-backed forces opened fire at Hadi's forces at the airport. So the rift that everyone was already aware of opened wider. The rift between the UAE and Saudi Arabia,
بين الإمارات والسعودية.
Bin Salman had sensed the danger and initially decided to act as the big brother and impartial mediator to forge reconciliation between Hadi and Abu Dhabi Crown Prince, who's also the UAE's deputy commander-in-chief, Bin Zayed. 2 weeks later, Hadi left for Abu Dhabi, but talks took only 10 minutes. Bin Zayed reminded Hadi that the UAE has paid a lot of money to liberate Yemen. And Hadi told Bin Zayed that the UAE acts like an occupying power in Yemen, not a country that's deployed forces to liberate it. Hadi decided to fire the UAE cronies in his government, which itself was designated by Saudi Arabia. Bin Salman was supposed to teach the UAE a lesson and force them to support Saudi policies and stop going their own way. Finally, on April 27th, 2017, bin Salman gave Hadi the green light to punish the UAE. Adarus Qasim al-Zubaydi, the governor of Aden, and Hani Ali bin Breik, one of the ministers of Hadi's cabinet, were fired. The UAE reacted quickly. A massive protest in Aden. This time, the groups in Aden sought independence in South Yemen.
انقسمت اليمن على مدى عقود إلى قسمين شمالي وجنوبي.
For decades, Yemen had been divided into two northern and southern parts. North Yemen, whose capital was Sana'a, gained independence from the Ottoman Empire in the last year of the First World War in 1918. But South Yemen remained under British control for several decades later. Aden, the capital of South Yemen, was an important port for UK colonial ships in West and South Asia for decades. In 1969, South Yemen became independent. Twenty-one years later, in 1990, South Yemen became united with North Yemen. 30 years later, the unity was about to collapse due to the UAE's meddlesome policies. After the war in Yemen, Hadi forces backed by the UAE and Saudi Arabia managed to occupy parts of what was called South Yemen in the past. North Yemen was still in control of Ansarullah forces, so South Yemen had turned into the only shelter for the Saudi-backed rebels. After the independence-seeking move in South Yemen, the bastion would be lost. Hadi was concerned. Bin Salman was even more concerned. Hadi's government was a bin Salman puppet and was supported by the U.S. ambassador. After the differences intensified, bin Salman realized that the UAE's offensive move wasn't against Hadi, but him. The UAE challenged Hadi's rule over Aden, even though it knew bin Salman backed him. It was a proclamation of war against bin Salman.
اتخذ محمد بن سلمان الخطوة التالية إذ أعلنها جهاراً بأنه يقف.
Bin Salman took the next step. He openly announced that he supports all decisions, measures, and arrangements by the Hadi government to restore security in Yemen. It means that Saudi Arabia allowed Hadi to crush the militants in South Yemen who were backed by the UAE. The STC, or the Southern Transitional Council, is a Yemeni group that wants to see South Yemen as an independent country in the international community. It meant that Hadi would lose his only base and bin Salman's war in Yemen would practically end in failure. The STC was formed on the 14th of May, 2017. Its leader was Adarus al-Zubaydi, the governor of Aden, who had just been deposed by Hadi. After receiving the thumbs up from bin Salman, Hadi immediately announced that the council was illegal, but the STC isn't just a political group. Its military branch, called the Security Belt Forces, was formed, a 15,000-strong militia group entirely funded by the United Arab Emirates. In January 2018, Zubaydi announced that the process of deposing Hadi and Aden had started. Now, a new front has opened for MBS. On January 28th, all administrative buildings of Hadi's government in Aden were captured. The SDC controlled the city. The spring in 2018 started while the Emiratis made another new move. Babu Mandab. It means the gate of wailing. The myth has it that once a battle took place in the region and the fugitives who passed from the strait cried over those who were killed, but some others say that the name has its roots in the slavery era when the strait was a crossing point for the ships that transferred slaves from Africa. So the name, the Strait of Wailing, was chosen because of the crying of the slaves. Beyond the world of mythology, the situation hasn't changed that much. Wailing can still be heard from the strait. This is part of Africa called the Horn of Africa. After Eritrea split from Ethiopia, it was a hot spot for long battles for several decades. On the other side of the strait, Yemen is located, another hot spot for war. But the emergence of a new economic power changed the equation. China has been in the region for a while, and in order to get closer to the strait, it has signed trade contracts with Ethiopia near the strait. China has established a special economic zone in Ethiopia. It manufactures electrical appliances, construction material, agricultural machinery, steel, and other metals in the zone. Even the small country near the strait, namely Djibouti, signed a contract with China. Now, based on that contract, China established a naval base near Djibouti. The base fights sea pirates. The beginning of the threat to the Western interests in Babu Mandab Strait. After China came to the region, everyone got worried. Now, the Persian Gulf Arab states consider control over the strait a major part of security in their region. Soon, Turks, Japanese, and Americans showed up for trade and gaining a foothold on the African side of the strait. Let's take a look at the strait once again. Sea transportation is the most important way of transit for goods and energy all across the world. If the strait is shut, the route becomes several times longer and the costs will also increase. As you can see, all ways lead to this strait. So, many countries showed up one after the other to invest on the African side. World economy was going through transformation. Economies like China, India, and Brazil were now on the list of top 10 countries with the highest GDP. These countries have young populations. The old rich countries, except for the U.S., are suffering from aging crisis. Their populations are getting older. It means the balance will gradually tip in favor of consumption and against production. Cheap labor force and new markets are the dream of the new capitalist system. In recent years, the economic growth of the countries to the south of Bab el-Mandab Strait boosted because of the presence of foreign investors. Sudan, Ethiopia, Djibouti, and Eritrea experienced an economic growth of 5 to 9%. The growth did not exist in these countries during the past years. Something new was happening. Arab countries also showed up. From 2000, the investment of Arabs started in the Horn of Africa. It was mainly in Sudan and Ethiopia that reached $13 billion as of 2017. That was a time when the war in Yemen started with Saudi, U.S., and UAE meddlesome policies. The problem in the north of the strait should have been resolved. Let's review the developments in the strait in recent years. A civil war broke out in Somalia, Eritrea split from Ethiopia, Sudan was divided into northern and southern parts, and now it was Yemen's turn. All of these developments took place near the vital strait, yes, reviving the issue of North and South Yemen, or the Southern Transitional Council, was supported by the UAE. It didn't stop with supporting the secessionist group and personally got involved. This is Socotra Island, Yemen's large and strategic island in the Indian Ocean en route to Bab el-Mandab. Any country that takes control of the island will practically control one of the most strategic routes in the world with heavy traffic. The Asma Island belongs to Yemen, but it's been abandoned for a while because of the war. Only a UAE military unit stays on the island. In the 2015 tempest, the island was badly damaged. The island's infrastructure was demolished. The war in mainland Yemen was ongoing, and no group could help the island. The Emiratis took advantage of the situation. UAE aid and rescue forces were the first ones to arrive on the island. Afterwards, the military forces showed up. They had come to train the militia group affiliated with them on Socotra. It was the same strategy they devised for Aden and South Yemen. Hence, the UAE gained a foothold in the strategic island. Abu Rabu Mansur Hadi's vice president, Ahmed Obeid Ben Daghir, announced the occupation of Socotra port and airport by the United Arab Emirates was a violation of Yemen's national sovereignty. The UAE knew that it has the upper hand. In secret meetings with the U.S. and Zionist officials, it agreed to normalize ties with the occupying regime. For the UAE, the normalization would help it get closer to Washington, so it believed that in the developments in Yemen, it would have the upper hand. The UAE handed Socotra over to the STC, but considering the relations between Zionist regime and the UAE and the STC, we could say that South Yemen and Socotra were in the occupying regime's clutches. To some extent, things went as the UAE had planned. Donald Trump didn't want to disturb the Abu Dhabi-Tel Aviv normalization, so he didn't side with Israel, and he only said the two sides need to reduce tensions. The young Saudi ruler now faced a bitter reality. He cannot even control his ally, namely the tiny nation of the UAE. In fact, the UAE had entered the Yemen war with the goal of economic development. The carnage of people in Yemen, famine, disease, hunger, and ruining all welfare indices were the costs that the Yemenis had to pay so the UAE could progress. But the loser of the game was Bin Salman. He never realized that he was ditched by his closest ally in the region. In 2019, when Hadi's forces moved to Aden for a massive attack, UAE fighter jets launched a blitzkrieg on Hadi forces on August 29, 2019. It was a complicated situation. For the Houthis and Ansarullah, the UAE was like Saudi Arabia as they both targeted civilians. But at the same time, the Emiratis moved against Hadi, who was appointed by Riyadh. The situation put Bin Salman in a tough spot. On April 26, 2020, the situation became more complicated for Hadi and Bin Salman. The STC claimed autonomy.
This is the Heart of Life pounding IRIB English Radio.
The limelight.
Military posturing in the Asia-Pacific also risks nuclear war and the potential extinction of the human species, says Anne Wright, former U.S. diplomat who resigned in March 2003 in opposition to the war on Iraq, in an article published under the heading Largest ever U.S.-NATO naval war drills in Pacific, a threat to both peace and marine life. Stay tuned for more. While the world's attention is focused on the crisis in Eastern Europe, halfway around the world in the Pacific Ocean, confrontation of the US and NATO toward China and North Korea is taking an increasingly military turn. The US military's Indo-Pacific Command, headquartered in Honolulu, Hawaii, Rim of the Pacific, or RIMPAC 2022, Military War Games will have 38 ships from 26 countries, 4 submarines, 170 aircraft, and 25,000 military personnel practicing naval war maneuvers in the Hawaiian waters from June 29th to August 4th, 2022. Additionally, ground units from 9 countries will come ashore on the islands of Hawaii in amphibious landings. Many citizens of the 26 RIMPAC countries do not agree with their country's participation in the RIMPAC war games, calling them provocative and dangerous for the region. The Pacific Peace Network, with members from countries and islands across the Pacific, including Guam, Jeju Island, South Korea, Okinawa, Japan, Philippines, Northern Mariana Islands, Aotearoa in New Zealand, Australia, Hawaii, and the United States demand that RIMPAC be cancelled, calling the naval armada dangerous, provocative, and very destructive. The network's petition for cancellation of RIMPAC states that RIMPAC dramatically contributes to the destruction of the ecology system and aggravation of the climate crisis in the Pacific region. RIMPAC war forces will blow up decommissioned ships with missiles, endangering marine mammals such as humpback whales, dolphins, and Hawaiian monk seals, and polluting the ocean with contaminants from the vessels. Land forces will conduct ground assaults that will tear up beaches where green sea turtles come to breed. The petition rejects the massive expenditure of funds on war making when humanity is suffering from lack of food, water, and other life-sustaining elements. Human security is not based on military war drills, but on care for the planet and its inhabitants. Other citizen groups in the Pacific region are adding their voices to the call to cancel RIMPAC. In its statement about RIMPAC, the Hawaii-based Women's Voices, Women Speak declared that RIMPAC causes ecological devastation, colonial violence, and gun worship. RIMPAC's ship sinking, missile testing, and torpedo blasting have destroyed island ecosystems and distributed sea creatures' well-being. This convening of military personnel promotes toxic masculinity, sex trafficking, and violence against local populations. In a June 14, 2022 opinion piece in the Honolulu Star Advertiser, the only statewide newspaper in Hawaii, three local activists with the Hawaii Committee for Human Rights in the Philippines wrote, "We are one with the people of Hawaii in opposing the U.S.-led wars for which Balikatan, U.S.-Philippine ground war maneuvers and RIMPAC are warm ups. As it is, the governments bring together the people of Hawaii and the people of the Philippines to prepare for war, death, and destruction. Military posturing in the Asia-Pacific also risks nuclear war and the potential extinction of the human species. We must instead work toward global cooperation to address the threat of climate change and biodiversity loss to build toward peace, life, and coexistence," unquote. The citizens' petition to cancel RIMPAC has individual signatures and organizational endorsers from around the world. 2022 RIMPAC includes military forces from Australia, Brunei, Canada, Chile, Colombia, Denmark, Ecuador, France, Germany, India, Indonesia, the Zionist regime, Japan, Malaysia, Mexico, Netherlands, New Zealand, Peru, the Republic of Korea, the Republic of the Philippines, Singapore, Sri Lanka, Thailand, Tonga, the UK, and the US. 40% of RIMPAC participants are either in NATO or have NATO ties. 6 of the 26 RIMPAC countries are members of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization NATO, including Canada, Denmark, France, Germany, the UK, and the US, while 4 other participating countries are Asia-Pacific partners of NATO, including Australia, Japan, South Korea, and New Zealand. In the Pacific, NATO forces coming into the region greatly increased the tension with China and North Korea. Military-naval events, both in practice and in war, are dangerous for humans and for marine mammals. Scores of dolphins have turned up dead on the coast of the Black Sea from that war. The intense ship noise and low-frequency sonars interfere with the dolphins' main means of communication. Disruptive underwater noises may either have them end up losing their way in large fishing nets or around the Black Sea shores. The Turkish Marine Research Foundation announced recently that more than 80 dolphins were found dead across the country's western Black Sea coast, an extraordinary increase in the number of marine mammals found dead in a typical year. A recent video from the Black Sea documents some of the 80 dead dolphins. Several studies in the past have confirmed that military sonars are harmful to marine life, and many militaries have adopted mitigating measures to protect wildlife. Whales and dolphins have been killed in U.S. military war exercises by sonars and bombs. In March 2000, the U.S. Navy admitted that its use of a high-intensity sonar system caused 16 beaked and mink whales to be stranded on beaches in Bahama shortly after U.S. Navy ships using high-intensity sonar had passed by. 6 of the whales died, and autopsies on the mammals revealed bleeding around the whale's inner ears and, in one instance, in the brain. 10 whales were pushed back into the sea, but a declining sightings of beaked whales led researchers working in the area to believe that many more may have died. The Navy and the National Marine Fisheries Service, NMFS, launched a series of investigations with the interim synopsis of the reports concluding that the bleeding was caused by sound waves produced by high-intensity sonar. With almost twice as many military ships arriving in the Hawaiian waters than the Russian Navy has in the Black Sea, the dangerous effects of the RIMPAC war maneuvers on dolphins, whales, and fishes will be substantial. The effect of RIMPAC military war exercises on international relations in the Pacific region may also have dangerous, intended or unintended consequences that could put the region into ever-increasing military confrontation instead of dialogue. Major cities in Asia, including Beijing, Shanghai, Hong Kong, Seoul, Tokyo, Pyongyang, and Moscow, could be targeted and destroyed by ballistic missiles from the U.S. and NATO. In the United States, Honolulu, Haganta, Guam, Washington, D.C., New York, San Francisco, Los Angeles, San Diego, Seattle, Houston could be targeted by missiles from other countries. Cities in Europe, including London, Paris, Rome, Madrid, Amsterdam, could be damaged or destroyed. Military responses to perceived national security issues by any of the countries in the region, whether it be North Korea, China, Russia, or the United States, will be disastrous for peoples over the entire planet. Experts must not let the governments continue confrontation instead of dialogue to resolve national security issues. The lives of people around the world are at stake. Experts must not let those who make money and political status out of war win again and start another horrific war for peace.
Africa Today.
The government of Eritrea has compelled the Israeli regime to close its embassy in the country after it rejected an ambassador appointed by the Tel Aviv regime. Now, the decision marks yet another moment of continued isolation of the Israeli regime in Africa. It's not surprising that Eritrea took that decision because the Israeli regime, which is trying to infiltrate Africa, has deeply rooted racist and apartheid policies. In fact, Jacques Yosef, a senior Israeli rabbi, believes that the people of Africa are monkeys. Let's take a listen. Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and it's always great welcoming you here at Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative analysis of news making headlines in Africa. Now, this week's edition is focusing on the decision by the Israeli regime to close its embassy in Eritrea, a strategic Horn of Africa nation. We're asking, is the move a pointer to further isolation of the Tel Aviv regime in Africa? The second part of our program today will be on the drought currently ravaging parts of Sudan, where aid agencies say that nearly one quarter of the entire population will struggle to access food in the coming months. We're asking, what needs to be done to utilize Sudan's massive potential in agriculture? Our experts will be giving us their incisive analysis on these two subjects today.
Eritrea rejects Israeli regime. Israeli regime's Prime Minister Yair Lapid has been forced to close the regime's embassy in Eritrea as authorities in this strategic northeast African country have rejected the ambassador appointed 2 years ago by Tel Aviv. On July 5, 2020, the regime's Foreign Ministry's Appointments Committee appointed Ismail Khaldi to serve as ambassador to Eritrea. The approval of his appointment was, however, rejected by Eritrean authorities. According to Israeli media outlets, the embassy had remained empty in the aftermath of Eritrean government's decision.
While the Eritrean government has not issued a statement on the closure of the Israeli embassy in Asmara, the decision comes as many international organizations have clearly stated that Israel is an apartheid regime. So, just as the South African white minority apartheid regime was isolated internationally, there are indicators that many African countries, including Eritrea, believe that Tel Aviv is a racist regime. Clearly, early this year, Amnesty International stated that Israel is an apartheid regime.
Amnesty International is here today to call on the authorities of Israel to put an end to the system of apartheid it is maintaining against all Palestinians living under their effective control, whether in Israel itself, in the OPT, or as refugees in other countries. We are here today to call on the international community to take resolute action against the crime of humanity being perpetrated in order to maintain the system of apartheid.
Now, for more on the decision to close the Israeli regime's embassy in Asmara, we contacted Ineem Richardson, the co-founder of Thomas Sankara Center for African Liberation and Unity. Thanks a lot for joining us today, madam.
Thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Now, what prompted the government of Eritrea to reject the ambassador appointed by the Israeli regime?
Well, one thing to understand about Eritrea is that Eritrea is a country that is extremely adamant and proud about guarding its own national sovereignty post its independence. And so Eritrea is the only country in Africa that does not have a military relationship with the United States through AFRICOM, a huge assertion of sovereignty on a continent that's otherwise pretty dominated by imperialist intervention. Eritrea also has a long history of solidarity with the Palestinian people, dating at least as far back to its independence struggle. So Eritrea and the Palestinian Liberation Organization and the general Palestinian freedom struggle were really close allies throughout the latter half of the 20th century. Israel, on the other hand, took the side of Ethiopia, which was under a very repressive regime during the time that was repressive not only to the Eritreans who were fighting for their independence, but also for many of the peoples within Ethiopia. So Israel has this history of intervening in the Horn of Africa against the interests of the Eritrean people, as well as the interests of the Ethiopian people as well.
Eritrea is strategically located in the Horn of Africa on the Red Sea and the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, making it a geopolitically strategic and important state along the world's busiest shipping lane. Eritrea's Foreign Minister Osman Saleh Mohammed believes that the unipolar world order is coming to an end and that the conflicts in Africa are instigated by external powers.
In as far as global trends is concerned, I had stated, and I quote, the world is on the cusp of a new world order. All vital parameters indicate that the unipolar world order has come to an end or is in its twilight year. The economic power balance is inexorably changing with a spike in attendant intense rivalries and upheavals.
What are the implications for the Israeli regime following Eritrea's rejection of its envoy, particularly considering the strategic importance of this country?
As you mentioned, Eritrea is located on the Red Sea. It straddles, you know, it's right between these two parts of the world. It's not so far from Yemen and the countries of the Gulf, but it's also part of the African continent. So the Horn of Africa is very much like a gateway into the rest of Africa from Israel's point of view, based off of where Israel is located. So by not having access to Eritrea in this way, it prevents Israel in some way, it blocks Israel off from the rest of the continent. And Israel has had a long history of intervention, not just in the Horn, but other parts of Africa. Solidarity with the apartheid regime of South Africa historically, intervention in Uganda as well in the 70s. But through not having access to Eritrea, which would be one of the closest points of access into the African continent for Israel, it's a step back in terms of being able to penetrate directly and access these other parts of the continent as well.
Last year, at least 14 countries, including Eritrea, vehemently opposed Israeli regime's observer status at the African Union and agreed to expel it from the 55-member bloc. Now, a leading Pan-Africanist, PLO Lumumba, says he sees no merit in the Israeli regime being an observer member of the African Union.
I find no merit in Israel enjoying observer status at the African Union. And thirdly, I am puzzled why that is important at all. I do not see any value at all that is added by Israel enjoying observer status at the AU, unless there are certain subterranean political interests which are at play in this particular matter.
Activists in African countries have been working to intensify their struggle against Israeli regime's apartheid practices against Palestinians. These activists say Israel must be isolated the same way that apartheid South Africa was sanctioned, In February, the African Union suspended the debate on whether to withdraw Israel's accreditation as an observer to the bloc. The move by Eritrea to reject Israeli regime's ambassador is seen as a pointer of further isolation of the regime in Africa.
We certainly hope so, and I do believe that Israel's relationship with Africa as a whole is really on shaky grounds. It's not something that's very stable or sustainable because it's very unpopular with the majority of the people who are living within Africa. Because Israel has such a close relationship to a lot of the countries that have historically intervened, and even in recent times intervened for regime change in Africa, because of Israel's relationship to the United States, France, the UK, and other colonial and neocolonial powers, it means that sometimes African countries don't always act within the interests of their people, as well as their own national interests as a whole. But because of how generally unpopular Israel is in Africa among the people, it is really hard to, this sort of relationship would be really, really hard to defend and sustain. So Eritrea leading the fight against the normalization of this sort of relationship is really significant.
The Israeli regime is known to meddle in the internal affairs of African countries in a bid to push its nefarious agenda. Now, recently, the regime's notorious Mossad spy agency was implicated in a plot to overthrow the government of the Democratic Republic of Congo. Now, is Eritrea at risk of being destabilized by the Israeli regime?
Eritrea is going to do everything it can to maintain its sovereignty, which it's demonstrated time and time again that it prioritizes its own sovereignty in the face of a world that is, dominated by Western imperialism, and then in this sort of vein, Israel's allyship with the Western imperialists. So Eritrea is going to try everything to guard its own sovereignty, but it is threatened for regime change already by Israel and ally states. So we see U.S. sanctions on Eritrea as one example of this. So there's already an effort to try to destabilize Eritrea in this way. And this is something that is at risk. The risk is intensified by this decision to reject Israel. Because Eritrea is on such a divided continent, and there is a lack of concrete African unity on a political level, it really does make the risk heightened in a lot of ways.
Addressing the African Union summit held in Addis Ababa last February, Palestinian Prime Minister urged African countries to reject the Israeli regime due to the apartheid policies it imposes on Palestinians.
Israel should never be rewarded for its violation and for the apartheid regime it does impose on the Palestinian people. As an entity, Israel has progressed from extremism to militarism to colonial expansion.
Eritrea and other African countries have for long supported the liberation of Palestinian territories occupied by the Israeli regime. So why is the liberation of Palestine important for African countries?
The liberation of Palestine is super important for African people and for the liberation of the African continent. If you look at historically, we see that almost pretty much all of the revolutionary struggles, all of the struggles that were in line with the people in Africa, whether it's the Eritrean struggle for their independence, whether it's Thomas Sankara in Burkina Faso, whether it's the struggle of the peoples of South Africa against apartheid and also against settler colonialism and these things, we see that the people are always on the side of Palestine because we recognize that the history is very, very similar. It's a history of colonialism. It's a history of imperialism, of exploitation, and of occupation. It's the same enemies. Israel was created through the United Kingdom or by the United Kingdom during this epoch of the British Empire, the same British Empire that dominated the majority of Africa during the late 19th, 20th century. So we have this shared history of struggle against oppression.
Well, there you have it. The shared history of the struggle against colonialism and imperialism is a factor in Africa's opposition to the Israeli regime and support for Palestinian independence struggle. I'd like to thank our guest, the co-founder of Thomas Sankara Center for African Liberation and Unity, for her insight today. We now take a short break before our next topic, which is on the drought ravaging Sudan. So stay with us.
drought ravaging Sudan.
Aid agencies say millions in Sudan will struggle to access food in the coming months, including 3.1 million people facing emergency levels of hunger. Displaced children and their families, refugees, and people directly impacted by conflict are likely to be most vulnerable to hunger.
The ongoing crisis has been exacerbated by a worsening economic situation, recurring violence throughout many states, a poor harvest, and the global price shocks in the fuel, grains, and other food commodities.
Sudanese farmers are struggling to find new crops as the government has failed to buy their harvest under promised terms. A Sudanese farmer says they are facing a difficult situation.
The summer season is threatened with collapse. 50%, 70% of us might not plant, and that puts the food supply in question. Farmers are in a difficult position. People are in a difficult position. The situation has become very difficult.
Now, to discuss the food security situation in Sudan, we contacted Adel Abdelati, the chairman of the Sudan of the Future Political Bloc. Now, aid agencies say Sudan is facing a severe shortage of food and medicines, leading to the spread of malnutrition and diseases. Now, is the situation getting worse in this country?
Yes, unfortunately, Sudan is facing a big shortage of food. Sudan is importing wheat from Ukraine and from Russia. And we know that now there is no supplies from these two countries. And about 18 million of people are facing the danger of hunger and shortage of food. This situation should be addressed and should be solved as soon as possible, because otherwise we will have a humanitarian crisis in Sudan.
Thousands of protesters continue to organize massive protests in Sudan's capital and other parts of the country in demonstrations against the country's ruling military generals. A Sudanese protester says they will continue with street demonstrations to ensure that remnants of the former regime don't remain in power.
We believe this revolution needs to be monitored so as not to be hijacked by members of the former regime or even by political parties.
Apart from the Ukraine crisis, has the political instability in Sudan contributed to the food shortage in the country?
That is true. The instability in the country, of course, a situation where there is lack of security, there is lack of stability on the political level. There is no, in fact, government. We don't have a prime minister. We don't have a government which has some kind of popular support. And all the time we have demonstrations. And in fact, we have a failed government and a failed state. And this, of course, is worsening the situation. Also, bad economic decisions, because farmers in Sudan, they have collected a very good collection of wheat in this year, but the policies of the government and the policies of the agriculture bank, by forcing non-commercial, non-rental, prices for the Sudanese wheat has resulted in farmers refusing to sell their products.
A joint report from the World Food Program and the Food and Agriculture Organization last June concluded that 15 million people in Sudan face acute food insecurity. These UN agencies say projections for later in the year indicate that this might be increasing to some 18 million people.
WFP Sudan has just completed its food security assessment. Unfortunately, our worst fears have been confirmed. We estimate at this point in time that some 15 million people are going hungry in Sudan. Our projections for later in the year indicate that this might be increasing to some 18 million people.
NATO's imperialism, military expansionism, which ignited the Ukraine conflict,